At the NATO summit, President Volodymyr Zelensky is getting at least some of what he's asking for.
The US, Germany, the Netherlands, Romania, and Italy will provide Ukraine with 5 additional strategic air defense systems.
Plus, ceasefire negotiations are in jeopardy as dozens are killed in Gaza.
And Palestinian medical officials say at least 29 people were killed. The Israeli military said it was reviewing reports that civilians were harmed.
And later, donations pour into the children's hospital in Kyiv. Turkey looks to Russia for help with Syrian refugees and an introduction to Keir Starmer, Britain's new prime minister. Today is Wednesday, July 10th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. On Tuesday, U.S. President Joe Biden welcomed NATO leaders to Washington and praised the alliance's 75th anniversary, all while making the case for peace through strength amid the largest challenge that Europe has faced in many decades. Other administration officials made similar arguments for bolstering defense to fight global threats. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Washington.
President Joe Biden made a forceful case for peace through strength as NATO members gathered Tuesday in Washington to mark the 75th anniversary of the Security Alliance as it faces what may be the biggest test in its history.
It's good that we're stronger than ever because this moment in history calls for our collective strength. Terrorist groups continue to plot evil schemes to cause mayhem and chaos and suffering. In Europe, Putin's war of aggression against Ukraine continues. And Putin wants nothing less than Ukraine's total subjugation, to end Ukraine's democracy, to destroy Ukraine's culture, and to wipe Ukraine off the map. And we know Putin won't stop at Ukraine, but make no mistake, Ukraine can and will stop Putin.
His argument was bolstered by other members of his administration on Tuesday, with his national security advisor speaking to defense industry executives and invoking a Roman adage, if you want peace, prepare for war. And the alliance's chief began making his pitch, literally and rhetorically, right after landing in Washington.
Great pitch, once again, Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg.
Sign a new defense industrial pledge. And that will be a pledge will help to make our industry across Europe and North America stronger, more innovative, and capable of producing at scale.
Biden, in his remarks, acknowledged Stoltenberg's role in the alliance by surprising the former Norwegian Prime Minister with the U.S.'s top civilian honor, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. But analysts ask whether this show of presidential power at the summit can obscure Biden's obvious political troubles at home, after a poor debate showing led to mounting calls for him to leave November's presidential race. Giselle Donnelly is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. She spoke to VOA on Zoom.
It should remind us of the criticality of American leadership of this alliance. It is an American creation. It survives and prospers and thrives and has thriven on American leadership. And when doubts arise about American leadership and American leaders, the alliance, you know, when the American president catches a cold, NATO gets pneumonia.
It's a sobering thought as NATO meets under the hospitality of an embattled American president, that his weakness, and likewise his strength, are contagious. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
As the NATO summit continues, Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has already racked up some early prizes for his country. VOA's Anna Chernikova has the story from Kyiv.
President Joe Biden, at the opening of the NATO summit in Washington on July 9th, announced the provision of new Patriot systems to Ukraine, calling this decision historic. He said that the US, Germany, the Netherlands, Romania, and Italy will provide Ukraine with 5 additional strategic air defense systems, and in the coming months, the U.S. will provide Ukraine with dozens of additional tactical air defense systems of shorter radius range. The Norwegian government said it will transfer 6 F-16 fighter jets to Ukraine, some of which should arrive later this year. The Prime Minister of Norway noted that in combination with air defense systems, this will be a significant contribution to the defense of Ukraine. During his speech at the Reagan Institute in Washington, President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed the hope that the United States will lift all restrictions on strikes on the territory of Russia, and this will allow Ukrainian cities to be protected from strikes by guided aerial bombs.
Imagine how much we can achieve when all limitations are lifted. Similarly, now we can protect our cities from Russian guided bombs if American leadership makes a step forward and allows us to destroy Russian military aircrafts on their bases. This will also yield an instant result. And we are waiting for this step. And we can significantly limit Russian actions in southern Ukraine and push the occupier out of there if American leadership assists us with the necessary deep strike capabilities against Russian military and logistics in our Ukrainian Crimea.
Zelensky emphasized the need for American leadership, which does not wait but acts now. He gave the example of a new Russian offensive in the Kharkiv region, which was stopped by the U.S., allowing the armed forces of Ukraine to retaliate with Western weapons against military targets in Russia. Imagine how much we can achieve when all restrictions are lifted, Zelensky said. According to him, this decision can bring an immediate result, and Ukraine is waiting for this step. Meanwhile, following the destruction of the Ohmadid Children's Hospital, more than $7 million from Ukrainian citizens and businesses were collected in 2 days for the rebuilding of the hospital, which was partially destroyed by a Russian missile on Monday. The Ukrainian government and several of Ukraine's Western allies also announced providing additional funds to rebuild Ohmadid and other medical facilities which were destroyed as a result of the recent Russian shelling. Some countries have also agreed to purchase new medical equipment to replace what was destroyed. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
And now to the Middle East. Palestinian officials said an Israeli airstrike in the southern Gaza Strip killed more than 24 people, while advancing tanks in Gaza City forced residents to flee under fire as Israel stepped up its military offensive. It's a move that Hamas says could imperil the ongoing ceasefire negotiations. Reuters' Gabe Singer has the story.
Bodies piled up at Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza on Tuesday as Israel stepped up an offensive that Hamas warned could jeopardize ceasefire talks. Palestinian medical officials said an Israeli strike nearby killed dozens of Palestinians, most of them women and children. This woman lost her son in the strike.
He was at the Muntanabi school with a number of residents at the school gates. I would say it was targeted, but they are targeting children. Israel was only successful with killing children, humans, and demolishing buildings, but they did not beat the resistance, nor will they be able to.
The airstrike hit the tents of displaced families outside a school in the town of Abasan, east of Khan Yunis. And Palestinian medical officials say at least 29 people were killed. The Israeli military said it was reviewing reports that civilians were harmed. It said the incident occurred when it struck with, quote, precise munition, a Hamas fighter who took part in the October 7th raid on Israel that precipitated the 9-month-long Israeli assault on Gaza. Meanwhile, Hamas's media office said Israeli strikes elsewhere in central Gaza killed 60 Palestinians and wounded dozens of others, including a strike on a home in al-Nusrat, which killed 17 people, most of whom were children. Meanwhile, residents said advancing tanks in Gaza City shelled roads and buildings, forcing them to flee their homes. This was followed by Israeli military orders posted on social media to evacuate several districts in eastern and western Gaza City. The Palestinian Red Crescent transported dozens of injured from a hospital in Gaza City on Sunday and Monday, but on Wednesday said that its crews were unable to answer dozens of distress calls due to the intensity of the bombing there. Israel's renewed campaign has threatened talks at a crucial time, as senior U.S. officials are in the region to push for a ceasefire after Hamas made concessions last week. Hamas quoted its leader as saying that the latest fighting could bring negotiations, quote, back to square one.
That's Gabe Singer of Reuters reporting for us today. Meanwhile, elsewhere in Israel, on Wednesday, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said the Israel Defense Force, or IDF, has killed a majority of Hamas militants.
We have eliminated or wounded 60% of the Hamas terrorists. We have disbanded 24 battalions, or the vast majority of them. We have returned half of the hostages, and we are determined to retrieve the rest. And all of us, the security establishment and myself heading it, are determined to achieve the goals of the war and complete them.
Speaking in the Israeli parliament, he also said that draft notices would be delivered in the next few weeks to some ultra-Orthodox Jews who had previously been exempt from serving in the Israeli military. Israel's Supreme Court ruled last month that the defense ministry must end their long-standing exemption from mandatory military service. The military service exemption is a contentious subject in Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government, as his fragile coalition relies on two ultra-Orthodox parties that oppose the end of the exemption to stay in power. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. An introduction to Keir Starmer, Britain's new prime minister, coming up in just a moment. But first, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants Russia to be part of talks with Syria on the return of millions of refugees. Erdogan's call this week for dialogue follows protests and rioting by Turks who want their government to stop hosting refugees from Syria's 13-year-old civil war. VOA's Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
This month's rioting against Syrian refugees across several Turkish cities triggered President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's call for dialogue with his Syrian counterpart Bashar al-Assad. Erdogan wants to discuss a way to return the Syrian refugees who Turkey has hosted since the start of the Syrian conflict in 2011. Soli Özel teaches international relations at Istanbul's Kara Has University.
In this environment, the Syrians become an easy target, and the country is fed up with their presence, rightly or wrongly. And this is a very potent political issue. Therefore, it is pretty important that at least a semblance of orderly departure for the Syrians who are in Turkey can be presented to the country in a believable way.
Growing animosity towards the more than 3 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, along with nearly triple-digit inflation, were key factors behind the losses Erdogan's party suffered in the March elections. Analysts say Russian leader Vladimir Putin welcomes Erdogan's efforts to open dialogue with Syria, as it could represent a loss of Turkish support for the Syrian rebels and an end to the civil war. This would be advantageous to the Russian leader as he looks to shift his military resources from Syria to Ukraine. But Turkey's significant military presence in Syria could be a stumbling block to talks. Turkish forces are deployed to fight Kurdish forces that Ankara accuses of being linked to separatists in Turkey. Analysts say Damascus will likely press for Turkey's withdrawal of its forces from Syria as the price for the talks. Aydın Selcan is a former senior Turkish diplomat who served in the region and is now a foreign policy analyst for Turkey's MediaScope news portal.
Bashar al-Assad is dependent on Russians and Iranians and also to local warlords. And even inside his close circle, he needs to depend on other partners. So it's really he cannot, as Bashar al-Assad cannot push Turkey out of Turkish military presence out of Syria. He can only ask for Ankara to withdraw these troops and then start to talk with Ankara.
Erdogan rules out withdrawing Turkish forces from Syria, saying it's a matter of national security. Along with the riots in Turkey, unrest broke out in the rebel-held areas of northeastern Syria last week amid fears that Ankara may be preparing to abandon the rebels. There are also concerns that a Turkish pullout could bring a humanitarian disaster and reprisal by Assad forces. Fabrice Bollinger at Lyon University.
The regime come back in this area. The people, most of the people want to move to Turkey. And for Turkey, it's not possible to welcome 4 million of new refugees. Because these people know very well that if they stay under the control of the regime.
With tensions high in Turkey over the presence of Syrian refugees, Erdogan looks to Putin to soften Assad's stance on talks, which could happen in the coming weeks. Doreen Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Keir Starmer is the newly elected Prime Minister of Britain, but who is he and what can we expect from him and his government after its resounding victory in last week's elections? And why is one resident of 10 Downing Street not very excited by all this? To find out, I spoke with Jenny Mathers. She's a professor of international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales.
So Keir Starmer actually has a background as a human rights lawyer and has only been a member of parliament for about the last 5 years or so. So he actually came into parliament at the same time as his predecessor in number 10, Rishi Sunak. They're both elected in the same year, which was in 2019. So he had, you know, quite a substantial career as a lawyer before he even became an MP. But what happened in 2019 in the UK general election was that the Conservative Party not only was successful, but, you know, it was a real humiliation for the Labour Party under its previous leader, Jeremy Corbyn, who took the party in a much more leftward direction, very much, you know, much more along socialist principles. And many people saw it as quite a hard left move. And in the Labour Party in general, it was feared that Corbyn's leadership would make them unelectable into the future. So they were looking for somebody who was very different, had a different approach, a different sort of politics. And Keir Starmer was someone who really sort of rose to prominence within the Labour Party as someone who fit that bill, very pragmatic, much more centrist, much more interested in sort of being electable, but also in getting things done once in office, not an ideologue at all, as Jeremy Corbyn was.
So if he's seen as a pragmatic bridge builder domestically, what can we expect from his government in terms of foreign policy, especially now that he's in Washington for the NATO summit? He'll be meeting with President Biden later today. What can the world expect from him?
So I think there's going to be a lot of continuity with the previous UK government in terms of things like support for Ukraine. And, you know, Starmer has already said that he will honor the commitment that his predecessor made to spending 2.5% of GDP on defense, for example. He's already made very clear commitments to Ukraine, including reiterating that, you know, British supplied weapons can be used by the Ukrainians to hit Russia, you know, on Russian territory. And the new defense secretary, John Healey, has already been to Ukraine, even though they've only been in office for a matter of a few days. So on certain elements of policy, there'll be a lot of continuity. There's a lot of interest in strengthening the relationship with the US, strengthening the relationship with NATO, but also strengthening the relationship with the EU. And because, you know, this is one thing that the Conservative Party since Brexit has really struggled with is how do they, have a relationship with the EU while still being outside of it because they were so closely associated with, you know, the Brexit result. Whereas Starmer doesn't have that close association. He has more flexibility there. And he has clearly made it a priority to sort of build the bridges really towards Europe as well as towards the North Atlantic partners.
The British press is reporting on some other drama coming out of 10 Downing Street. This drama has four legs and four paws. What's the story there?
Right. Well, 10 Downing Street, which is where the Prime Minister lives, has a long-term cat resident, and his name is Larry the cat. And he's been there for more than 10 years. And he's seen many prime ministers come and go. But he doesn't like competition from other cats. And the Starmers already have a family cat who will be moving in with them. So we don't know quite how that's going to work. And we also know that the Starmers may be getting a dog soon as well, under pressure from the children in the family. So Larry may have to contend with both an alien dog and an alien cat. Given what I've said and what we know about Keir Starmer, I would expect his government in general to be very pragmatic and lacking in drama. So we may see drama perhaps perhaps only coming out of the confrontation among the pets and the animals, number 10, rather than among the politicians.
Well, if he can get the cats and dogs to get along, I'm sure he'll do well with Parliament. Professor Jenny Mathers, a professor of international politics at Aberystwyth University in Wales. Professor Mathers, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Burkina Faso in Western Africa is home to nearly 2 million people internally displaced by years of insecurity and conflict, many of whom are now trying to find jobs in the capital, Ouagadougou, or who are starting their own businesses. VOA's Gildas Da has this report narrated for us by Anthony Labruto.
More than 5 years ago, Sayoba Sawadogo, a farmer in his 40s, fled insecurity in his village of Silgaji and found refuge over 160 kilometers away in the capital city of Ouagadougou. He now owns and manages a money transfer store. He says when he arrived, he didn't have a job, but after initially starting small by selling cell phone credit, he eventually opened a mobile money transfer store.
When I arrived here, I didn't have a job. When you flee your village and then you have no job, you try to manage little by little to get by. So I tried selling cell phone credit. And little by little, I opened this mobile money transfer store.
Sawadogo managed to end his dependence on charity with the help of some residents of Ouagadougou. He has now established himself as a successful trader. He says he has been working at the store for 5 years and has been able to take care of his family.
I've been doing mobile money operations for 5 years now. Thanks to this, I managed to take care of my family.
Sawadogo says he uses the money he makes at a small store to assist other internally displaced people as much as he can, helping some to start their own small businesses. A few kilometers away in the Hamdalaye district, an internally displaced woman is hard at work. Armed with her sewing machine, she has been making the rounds in the markets in search of customers, and sometimes going out to meet customers. She didn't want to share her name for personal reasons. She says she has mastered the sewing machine, and if she can find a permanent place to conduct business, that would be great. She says she can sew at least one suit a day, and that's all she and her family live on.
I'm back in Hamdalaye sewing and earning a bit of money so I can take care of my family. I've mastered the sewing machine. If I can get permanent premises, that would be great. I can sew at least one suit a day. So really, that's all we live on.
Sometimes she works with her neighbor. She says a partner can make it easier to cope. She says there are many times when they manage to get some work, and there are other times when there are no customers. It's like that.
There are times when we manage to work, and there are times when there are no customers. So, it's like that.
The UN says more than 2 million internally displaced people live in Burkina Faso, with some dispersed in various parts of Ouagadougou. Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger have been in the midst of an insurgency by Islamist groups that have been going on for about a decade. Many internally displaced people are taking any jobs they can find until things get better and they can go home. Anthony Labruto for Gildas Da in Ouagadougou, Burkina Faso, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.